I'm Richard Fieldhouse, and I'm delighted again to be with Judith Harvey over Skype for the latest edition of the NASGP podcast. Hello, Judith.
Hello, Richard.
You've just returned from Colombia and have obviously full of energy because you've also put together another wonderful article for the NASGP magazine, which you've called Sin City, The Redemption. And so tell us how you are, tell us how Colombia was, and tell us what brought you to write this latest article.
Colombia is absolutely fascinating. Its history is appalling, with more or less constant civil war for several centuries. And of course, what it's famed for is cocaine trafficking and for the narcotraficante cartels, particularly in Medellin and in Cali, which led to thousands and thousands of deaths throughout the country and wrecked civil society. But since the FARC agreed to a ceasefire several years ago.
These are the FARC, these are the socialist rebels, aren't they?
That's right. Well, that's what they originally were. They became sort of vigilante groups, and they got into drug trafficking to fund their activities. The ways of making money for these groups in Colombia is kidnapping and extortion.
Kidnapping and extortion.
And drug trafficking. Huge number of people are kidnapped and money is paid or they're killed. But things have quietened down a lot, and Colombia is now beginning to exploit its fantastic tourist potential. Of course, tourism is probably the international industry for bringing money into poor countries. And Colombia has a lot to offer. It's generally safe. There are areas which are probably a bit risky to go in and things that are a bit risky to do. But there are plenty of places you can go. And as long as you exercise a bit of sense, there's no problem. And you know, you worry about taking your smartphone and you get to Bogota and you find that every street salesman has a smartphone. So you may not flash it around, but you feel a little less anxious.
Good. Just put it in a rather sort of second class case or something to keep it safe.
Yes.
So it's very different to the country that it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it was just a total no go area, and back in the times of Escobar and the Cali cartel. But was it your trip that then led you on to put together this article about drugs and narco trafficking?
Yes, it was. Yes. It's partly because we spent a few days in Medellin, which is, of course, Pablo Escobar's hometown. And they do a Pablo Escobar tour, which sounds like it might be very tasteless, but in fact, it was excellent. Very well done, very informative. We went to the cemetery where he's buried, which was interesting because it's high up on the valley side, look, so you get this fantastic view of the city. And his grave, it's not like Eva Perón's grave in Buenos Aires is mega and loads of tourists wherever you went. Well, if you go there, then loads of, you can tell where it is because of all the tourists. But Pablo Escobar, the cemetery doesn't allow raised headstones, they're just flat stones. And he's in one corner with some of his family and colleagues. And there are a few trees around, and that's it. But it's interesting. There was a young man sitting on the wall nearby, and I got chatting to him. And he said, why are you here? Why do foreigners come to see Pablo Escobar's grave? And I said, well, it's very much, you know, it's what we know. It's what about Colombia. It's, you know, that is the image Colombia has abroad. So it's interesting to see the Colombian view, or a Colombian view. And it's part of the history of the city. We can see the modern city, all the statues in the plazas and the excellent museums and the cafe life. It's to see how much has changed, how far Medellin has come since Escobar died 25 years ago. It is a touchy subject, and with Colombians, and you have to, if you want to talk to them about it, you have to go very carefully, because it's something that touched everybody one way or another. But people are enjoying a
renaissance,
peaceful life. yes.
And that's interesting. You talk about how Escobar and the drug trafficking has sort of almost defined modern Colombia. And so pulling back a bit and going then sort of focusing into your article, I think for me what your article does so well is starts to put things in perspective, and we'll go back to that word at the end, because of course perspectives is your new book, Judith. We must talk about that at the end. But that's what you do. And the very first page, you start talking about coca leaves, and how the conquistadors forced silver and gold mining in South America, and exploited the local South Americans, which, and that gold and that treasure came to Europe, and it was yet another catalyst in world civilization that has its roots back in cocoa leaves, and you start to melt that in quite beautifully. So tell us about this coca and how its rather benign use, as it were, in those days, and how that led on to sort of modern addiction for opioids.
Chewing coca leaves is a custom throughout the Andes, because it grows in the Andes. If you just chew it, it takes the edge off what is a very hard life up in the Altiplano, even if you're not mining silver for the Spaniards. It's still available. You can buy cocati. It's available everywhere. And it's touted as a remedy for altitude sickness. I have to say, I find acetazolamide more effective than coca. you know, it's perfectly legal. It's available everywhere. It's sold in tea bags.
Really?
Yes.
Gosh, what does that do to you? Put milk and sugar with it? I mean, how does that work?
It's
hobnob.
You choose. it tastes like a lot of herbal teas, sort of vaguely grassy.
Okay.
And it might numb your tongue slightly, but you know, it doesn't do anything huge.
Yeah.
It may ease altitude sickness, and it probably takes the edge off all sorts of pains. In Bolivia, in the Cerro Rico, they're still mining silver, and the conditions are still horrendous, and people still chew coca.
But it's not addictive. So what's coca's part in going on from that?
It's not. It doesn't create dependency to any great extent, as far as I'm aware. And it was discovering that you could extract cocaine, which was a very different beast, from coca leaves. I can't remember the process. There is a Cuca Museum in Bolivia, in La Paz, and they tell you all about it. And it also tells you about Coca-Cola, who keep their relationship. Well, it's obvious in the name, exactly what is in Coca-Cola is a very well-guarded trade secret.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yes. It was the refining of cocaine, which you can do in a jungle laboratory.
Hmm.
And the use of that, as we know, I don't know, is cocaine nasal spray still in the BNF? I haven't looked. When I did ENT as a house job, there were... we used a cocaine spray for anaesthetizing the nose before we cauterized nosebleeds.
Really?
And it was the one, so check in the BNF,
yeah.
but that's still available. But that was the one licensed medical use of cocaine in this country. But of course, it gives a big hit and you can earn good money. The problem. It is, as with growing opium poppies in the Himalayas, coca grows very well in conditions in which it is hard to get anything else to grow. It's easy to grow, it's easy to harvest, it's easy to transport, and you get a good price. Price for your coca leaves, although the price paid to the growers is obviously a tiny fraction of the price that it fetches on the streets of Seattle.
And in this article, we talk about though in those days of the conquistadors in Southern America. And the use of cocoa, but the actual hallucinogens were actually privileged, you say, to the mystics. But we as the West kind of latched onto that and actually start to make it more to much more of an open market. And so anybody could then sort of access these hallucinogens. Do you think that was the turning point when it had been, as I say, used as a relatively benign drug to actually become more the dependency route?
Yes, I think if you look worldwide, most cultures have an equivalent of coca. Betel nut in the Pacific and in Asia, for example, something which is very mildly psychoactive. It just kind of is a sort of comfort thing. But in most cultures, there are strongly psychoactive compounds like yagoe, which I wrote about in an article of about 6 months ago, I think. And they are generally reserved for use by shamans and mystics to enable them to go into a trance and do whatever shamans and mystics do, predict the future or put you in touch with the dead or all that. But because they took over your head, essentially. They weren't drugs for every day at all. They were for this special purpose. But what happened was the West gets onto them, and people who don't have to go and mine silver for a living 12 or 14 hours a day take them for recreational purposes.
And therein lies the problem, and how and how we as sort of modern society have then launched this war on drugs that you talk about in quite some depth and in lots of examples of how that just doesn't seem to be working and in fact is making things worse. I mean, how are you finding it? What would you say has escalated the drug trafficking and the criminal use of it?
well, I think it's multifactorial, destruction of coca farmers' livelihood hasn't stopped anything. It's just been wildly damaging. And all this pushes the use of mild drugs out of the frame and pushes much stronger stuff into the market. Sorry, I've forgotten what it was you asked.
Oh, it was the criminalisation of it, and we've got examples. How we've for example, relatively mild cannabis is then used to make spice and skunk and other drugs like that, and in a way, the criminalisation has almost created a market, or it has got rid of any competition, so it's able to flourish unchecked.
Yes, I think that's right. If you do away with the mild stuff, which you may disapprove of, and it may, you know, there's nothing much more boring than sitting with a load of people who've been smoking weed and who are laughing their heads off at something which appears to you stone cold sober as totally unfunny and ridiculous. But that's about it. The hard stuff actually destroys lives. It, and from the narcotraficantes' point of view, whether they be, you know, South American or whether they be in the Golden Triangle in Asia or in Afghanistan, selling the hard stuff, the profit margin is hugely more.
Yeah.
So the more people you get hooked, the more you create a society in which using cocaine, we'll stick with cocaine because we've been talking about South America, is something you do.
And hearing you talk about it in this way, and having read the article, and it being it's the end of March 2018, and we're hearing a lot in the press at the moment about Cambridge Analytica and this Facebook data scandal, and you talked about being at parties with people laughing away at something you don't quite understand. There are parallels here. Maybe I'm just drawing them unnecessarily, but there seem to be parallels with this and the and other ways in that large companies, possibly unregulated companies, companies that don't have big businesses that don't have competition so much, like the big Facebooks and Amazons and Googles, who are also still creating, turning our friends and colleagues when we see them at parties into zombies. I was at a pub recently, and I was my wife and I were both really struck. Sarah and I both really struck by the number of people sitting there on their smartphones, flicking the screen, clicking away, where there were people. In normal social situations, are sort of the sober people, as it were, and then these people seem to be totally hooked and addicted into a platform whereby someone else was making an awful lot of money. And of course, there isn't the murder and the and all that illegal activity so much, or so we're made to believe. But particularly with the illegal activity, but when we become addicted to stuff, when we use instant gratification, we're getting this. There's opioids are being created in our brain, and addictive processes are happening in our frontal cortex. And is this the modern? Is this a social platforms? Do you think have any bear any relation to what you've been talking about?
Well, I think that's a very interesting comparison, and I think it's increasingly valid one, that, you know, pressing the like button gives you a dopamine hit, and creates an addiction. And as you say, you see it, you go out and there's a whole group of people sitting together, not talking to each other, but looking at their phones. I think the reason that it isn't illegal is that the law hasn't caught up with what these big the Facebooks and so on are doing. And the recent revelations are the, one hopes, a step in the direction of understanding what power these unelected organizations have, and what they do with how much data they collect. And you can go on to Google, etc., and you can get the data that they're holding on you, and it's pretty terrifying. And understanding, Facebook, Google use may be free, but Mark Zuckerberg has made his zillions and zillions and zillions somehow, and that's from our data.
Yes.
And selling it to God knows.
When I hear people talk about Facebook and Google, and how would you define these businesses, these organisations, and the answer is, well, basically Facebook and Google, their customer is the advertiser. They are basically advertising platforms, and we, as their users who don't pay for it, are the product. And that is quite a sobering, startling way to think about it, and nothing that I could argue against, because that makes total sense. And that when every time we type something into Facebook, the advertiser is somehow going to be benefiting from it in this subversive way. But what people are talking about is about greater regulation of these companies, which makes perfect sense, in the same way that greater regulation makes perfect sense when it comes to horribly addictive drugs. And so could maybe it's not that laws and drugs and making things illegal, or maybe it's just part of the human condition that we will always have some. There's this something about endorphins and dopamine and opioids that we just can't ever regulate, and it's just will always be there. In the same way that we all eventually die, we all eventually succumb in some way to some sort of dependent behaviour or addiction. Is this part of the human condition, or are we going to sleepwalk again into another 10, 20, 30 years' time when we actually have... data traffickers rather than narco traffickers, social media traffickers? Where's it all going, Judith? And I don't know if there's an answer
already
to that.
We already have data traffickers, I'm sure. Facebook is a data trafficker. But there are so many people. It's so easy to get hold of data. Without anybody knowing, and we feed data into Google or Facebook or whatever, but data is available from so many sources if you are even mildly techie, and how we are going to control that, I don't know. I think perhaps the comparison with cocaine begins to break down, because the evidence is that legalizing drugs, actually, by abolishing the criminality, you abolish an awful lot of certainly the social and some of the personal costs of hard drugs. Where we go with data, I don't know. I think we're just beginning to think about it.
Yeah, it's early, still early days. You mentioned in the article about Portugal, interestingly, they have about going some way to deregulating the criminalization of certain drugs. And what's happened there?
They have criminalized drugs. Yes. And it's been going on. I can't remember when they decriminalized, but enough years ago for there to be some reliable data on the effect of decriminalization. And it's not a piece of cake, but it's certainly improved things in Portugal. The problems created by hard drugs have reduced substantially.
So
and once you decriminalize it, it's easier. It's easier to help individual users as well. So because it's no longer, you know, they're no longer lawbreakers or seen as lawbreakers.
So if you can.
Mm-hmm.
Go
carry
on.
No,
I was going to say, so if we can get this, as the data grows more robust and the research grows more robust, that to show that, give the evidence that decriminalisation is actually a way for us to effectively help our patients more. It's difficult to help patients when they're undertaking an illegal activity anyway, but will that help us as doctors with patients with their drug dependency?
Well, I think it certainly should. At the moment, we have the ridiculous situation that the number of people who are drug dependent is ever increasing, with the consequences that we know about, both personal and social. But help for drug users is, the funds are being cut.
Yeah.
There's huge resistance to so-called shooting galleries where people can inject with clean needles and in safety and not at the side of the road. But I think it is better to have somewhere where people have medical support, if necessary, clean needles, not out in the street, than people dropping their needles at the end of your road.
Yes, as you say, in nice leafy cul-de-sacs in London, you see you're still getting this problem. And towards the end of the article, you start to also draw sort of warnings with regards to what's happening with Brexit. And you mention, obviously, the less funding into treating drug dependency, but also with the prospect of our borders and the Northern Ireland borders and the stockpiling of drugs in Europe, waiting for the impending chaos at our own borders, for this to be a wonderful opportunity for from our own European narco traffickers to further flood the UK with yet more drugs. Where's it all going to end?
I don't know, but I think if our politicians continue to keep their heads in the sand, is going to end in huge social problems, enormous, and huge costs. And there are a lot of politicians, and not just people like Nick Clegg, who have done a lot of work looking at drug legalization, who at least privately are prepared to say they think legalization is the lesser of two evils, or, you know, the way to go. It's a positive step, but politically, perhaps with your constituency, and certainly with somebody like Theresa May, first as Home Secretary and now as Prime Minister, it's not going to happen.
Maybe we should have a referendum, another referendum.
No.
Sorry, I nearly fell off my chair when I said that. That's thanks, Judith. That's been wonderful. And lastly, your book, Perspectives. I'm holding a copy here in my hand, and it's just this came out a month or two ago, and it's available on Amazon on our website. This podcast from where you get your podcasts from, links through to the article on our website, and you'll be able to click on a link that will take you through to the Amazon store. You've already had, I believe, you've had a further interview, previous interview early this morning about the book as well. And it is a great read. It puts together over a decade worth of dozens and dozens of all Judith articles, beautifully laid out and put together in various sections on culture and practice and ethics and our senses, careers, politics and the future. Highly recommended. It's a great way, something great to sit down in front of the fire with and have a good old read. And it saves you having to flick through all the different pages on the website. So how's it going so far with the book? It's quite exciting.
Well, I've had a lot of positive comments from people who've read it, who say one thing. Several people say it's, the articles are just the right length to read when you go to bed before you go to sleep, but also that they have found them very interesting and stimulating, and have led them to think, which is very good. That's nice.
That's what they're for, aren't they?
Yes.
They're great.
Yeah.
Well, Judith, thank you ever so much. It's been really interesting, and I can't wait to the next article, whatever that's going to be about. Well, so where's your next trip going to be? Have you worked that out yet?
Going to Devon in a couple of weeks. Ooh. For a few days.
Well, that will bound to spawn an article or two, I'm sure.
I think I might go to sleep. I'll have some seaside and Dartmoor walks.
I think you deserve it. Well, Judy, thank you very much. Really good to talk to you.
And you, it's a pleasure.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.